Well, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Happy Sunday. Happy Super Bowl Sunday. It's an exciting day. It's kind of coming towards the beginning of spring. People kind of feeling the warmer weather. I work a little bit outside, so I'm excited about that. It is the Super Bowl. Big football fans? Anyone? A little bit? Patriots, Eagles. Who thinks Patriots?
Boo.
There you go. I actually grew up in South Jersey. We're a big Eagles fan, so. Eagles, anyone? Yeah? Anyone not care who wins the Super Bowl? They just want flu season to be over?
Yeah,
there we go. Okay. It's one of them. I'm going to be speaking today. I'm going to be speaking out of Judges. So I think I'm going to start just by reading you all the passage. And then we have a slide for it. So there we go. Judges 14. So I'm going to be going, the passage is going to be the beginning of Judges 14 as well as the beginning of Judges 15. I'm just going to skip a little of the middle portion for you all just so it's not too much to read. So if you're in your Bibles, yeah, Judges 14 and 15 is where we will be. Does someone want to read it from the crowd? Does anyone want to read it? If not, I can. Here we go. It says, "Then Samson went down to Tamar and saw a woman in Tamar, one of the daughters of the Philistines. So he came back and he told his father and his mother, 'I saw a woman in Tamar, one of the daughters of the Philistines. Now therefore, get her for me as a wife.'" In verse 3. "Then his father and his mother said to him, 'There's no woman among the daughters of your relatives or among the people that you would take as a wife from the uncircumcised Philistines.' But Samson said to his father, 'Get her for me. She looks good to me.'" And then we see the continuation of the story. After the marriage feast in Judges 15, Samson had left the marriage feast after some strife had happened between him and some of the other people over some coats, a riddle that was kind of done. It says, "After some days, in the time of the wheat harvest, Samson went to visit his wife with a young goat. 'I will go to my wife in the chamber,' but her father would not allow him to go in. And her father said, 'I really thought you utterly hated her, and so I gave her to your companion. Is not her younger sister more beautiful than she? Please take her instead.' Samson said, 'This time I shall be innocent in regard to the Philistines when I do harm to them.' So Samson went and caught 300 foxes and took torches and turned them tail to tail and put a torch between each of tails. And when he had set fire to the torches, he let the foxes go into the standing grain of the Philistines and set fire to the stacked grain and the standing grain as well as the olive orchards. Then the Philistines said, 'Who has done this?' And they said, 'Samson, the son of Law of the Timonite, because he has taken the wife and given her to her companion.' And the Philistines came up and burned her and her father with fire. And Samson said to them, 'If this is what you do, I swear I will be avenged on you. After that, I will quit.' And he struck them down hip and thigh with a great blow and went down and stayed in the cleft of the rock of Etam." So this is kind of an excerpt out of the Samson story. I don't give you all the full background, but most of you probably know, right, the story of Samson. He was someone that was given power by God, incredible power, right? He had the Spirit of God in him since birth, and he was able to do mighty works for God. You see just kind of a taste of this. My dad says he was the nuclear weapon of his day, right? He was someone that could not be beaten in battle. He was someone that struck down hundreds of Philistines with just the jawbone. And he also was even kind of clever with the way he would go about things, right? You look at with the burning of the field, right? An agricultural community, that was a huge way to destroy the Philistines. He was someone raised up by God to destroy the Philistines, but he was someone that did not last, right? He was the nuclear weapon of his day that blew up himself. I look at this because I'm actually going to be talking a little bit about foundations. How do we build a foundation that lasts? I thought it was kind of neat that John was talking to you about kind of the foundation of our church, right? So we're going to be going to look into foundations, and this sermon was kind of brought about by kind of a conversation I had with one of my coworkers. I work over at Alliance Redwoods. It's just a camp down the way. We have lots of different people kind of come through Alliance from different backgrounds. And one of them, his name was Dave. He's actually my boss. He used to be a ministry consultant. I didn't even know that was a job, but that's what he used to be. So he used to go around two different churches, and he would consult them. He's worked with over 40 different types of Christian ministries, the majority of them churches. And so one of the days I, you know, kind of offered to take him to lunch, and I, well, he ended up paying, but anyway, but I offered to take him to lunch, and he kind of just talked with me a little bit about, I wanted to know, like, what do you see churches? How do you see an effective church versus an ineffective church? I just wanted to kind of get some of his insight as someone that had been in ministry as to how ministry looks. And I thought it was very, very interesting because the conversation kind of took a turn that I didn't really expect. I expected him to kind of talk about, you know, different ways to make things more effective. You know, like this ministry is kind of effective, but if you do it this way, it could be more effective and different things like that. But he didn't really spend any time at all talking about it. He said, he just kind of looked me in the eye and said, listen, Mike, he's like, I'm not necessarily a good person to talk to. He goes, I've seen a lot of corruption in the church. And a lot, almost every church I've worked with, there's something in the foundation of the church, right? The moral foundation of the church that is just not right. And he says, honestly, I still love the church. I'm working for the church, but I have to fight against bitterness, right? Because it's so frustrating. He goes, every time I come in and I have this hope to, right, to kind of work with this church and make this church better, and there's these deep-seated issues, right, within the foundation of the church that are just broken. And it happens every single time. And it was kind of a sobering thought for me to think, right, as I want to go into ministry and we look at, even with us, right, we're starting a church, right, and it's easy for us to kind of just think about the different things that we could do, the different programs we can make and people we can reach, but it's sobering to think that in the long run, sometimes it doesn't matter necessarily what you do, but it matters the foundation you build, right, and if you can build a fancy house, but if you don't have a proper foundation, it's all going to crumble, and we become like Samson, right, where we have this great big impact for a time, and then we self-destruct, right? We have a great impact and self-destruct. John was even telling me the story of this church. We're in a building that used to be a church, right? Big church, a huge church within Santa Rosa, right around this area, and it had a great big impact, but then it was gone, right? And I think it's an interesting perspective that we can have as we start a church, if we can look long-term and we can think long-term, and how do we build a foundation in this church that will last? Because that's really the ticket, right? It's easy to build a church that has a big impact for a small time. It's hard to build a church that has a foundation to last and do the will of God and be obedient to God for the long-term. And how do we do that? And I think he gave two insights, two questions that we could ask ourselves and look into our lives and look into our church, and we could see whether or not we're going to be someone that lasts. And I think we see them illustrated in Samson. And so we're going to look into how that means for a church as well as how it looks in our personal life. Because it was interesting. I kind of talked with them a couple weeks ago, right? And it took about a week for it to really sink in and be like, all right, that's how it looks like in the church. How does it look like for me, right? And that's sometimes the harder question, but that's really the question that we have to look at. We're going to be looking at the life of Samson, and we're going to be asking ourselves, how do we build a foundation for a ministry that lasts? How do we build a foundation for a life that lasts? And it's really just the most important thing, right? Foundation for, like, it's a, you know, a cliche analogy, right? But foundation for a house is the most important thing. The foundation for our church is the most important thing. And we could all think of churches, right, that have had, that some of you might have even been a part of churches, right, that they were great, but as you stayed in there longer, you started to see behind the scenes, right? And that's really was Day's perspective. He says, we see the outside, right? We see the fancy house. He goes, but when you look behind the scenes, as you stay in a church longer, you start realizing the foundation has a hole in it, right? There's something wrong with the foundation. And similar to people in our lives, right? There's some people that look great on the outside, and it looks like they're going for God, but underneath, the foundation isn't there. And it ultimately crumbles, right? And that's not how you want to be. As a church, how can we build a foundation that will last? We're going to look at Samson. And the first thing we're going to look at, the first question I think that we have to ask ourselves as to whether or not we're going to last is, are we willing to live with a radical call to obedience to God? You can't really talk about Samson without talking about obedience to God. That was kind of the litmus test for Samson's life. If you know anything about Samson, so Samson was called, not only was he given great power, right, the Spirit of God was upon him, but he also was called to be a Nazirite. The Nazirite vow was a vow that usually people would take for a temporary time to show themselves as someone that was separated for God, almost like a fasting type of thing. And they wouldn't cut their hair, and they wouldn't drink wine, and they wouldn't touch anything dead. And we see this is someone, he was called to be a lifelong Nazarite. The classic, right, we think of Samson as someone with long hair, right? That is because of the Nazarite vow. And when he breaks this vow, right, when he disobeys God, that's when his strength leaves him, right? And it was the test of Samson. It was also the test of the Israelites during this time, right? God was seeing whether or not they would be someone who was obedient to God. And we see the reason why Samson self-destructed, the reason why he had a great impact but then fell, is because he never quite got the obedience thing down. And you see it both in him breaking his Nazarite vow as well as in other places in his life. And specifically in this passage, we talk about how he saw a wife of the Philistines, right? And he says he went down to the Philistines, and normally we wouldn't think of this as like a terrible, bad thing, right? It's someone, he sees someone he wants to marry, and he wants to get married to him. But if you look at the background, this is actually a big deal, because if you go back to Samson's original calling, he's called as someone who's going to deliver the hand of Israel from the Philistines, right? And so when he comes down and he wants to marry someone from the Philistines, he's asking to marry someone from the enemy. And he's specifically going against the command of God. So during this time, this is right after the time of Joshua, right? So God had called Joshua and the people of Israel to wipe out all the Canaanites in the land. He says, do not associate with the Canaanites because they will bring you away. They'll cause you to turn from me. And so they were on this big campaign to wipe it. These are like people like Jericho, right? They burned down Jericho, destroyed everything in it. And they're going, and then eventually, as Joshua gets to the end of his life, the Israelites decide not to start destroying the nations. And they leave certain pockets of nations within them. And so eventually God says, I'm no longer going to go out before you, and I'm no longer going to stop and kill the Philistines before you. He's like, but I'm going to test you to see whether or not you will be obedient. And he says, I don't want you to associate with them, I don't want you to marry them, and I don't want you to follow their gods. And if you know anything about Israel, right, this would be the thorn in their side throughout the entirety of their existence. They would constantly intermingle with these other people groups and begin to go to their gods. So this was not just Samson getting married. This is Samson turning from God's path, right? And we see the seed of disobedience that comes into Samson because he no longer has this radical pull for God. And I think the curious thing to look like is, why did Samson do this? Why did Samson choose this woman from the Philistines? Does anyone want to look in the passage and see? She looked good. Because she looked good, right? It uses the passage, she looked good in his eyes. And I think that it really was kind of that simple. Is Samson believed he was more into his desires than God's desired, right? He, somewhere along the course of his life, when he was kind of started in the spirit and he started kind of with this radical obedience of being this Nazarite, right? This desperation for God and this radical obedience for him, all of a sudden there's something in his mindset that shifted. And he started to look around him and he started to look at the other things in the world. And he says, this looks good in my eyes. And I think there's another reason why Samson told him. You have to kind of look into this a little bit deeper, because it's a specific phrase that this uses. It says he looked good in his eyes. And this phrase is used other times throughout Judges. And one of the places this is used is in Judges 17. And this is to describe the people of Israel during his day. And it says, in those days, there was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Same phrase, right? Same idea as with Samson, right? Where Samson goes, and he goes after the Philistine woman because she looked right in his eyes. She wasn't right in God's eyes, right? She wasn't right in his eyes, but she was right in Samson's eyes. And I think this kind of gets a little bit into the why as to why Samson would do that. I think that Samson wasn't necessarily a lone wolf when he turned against God. I think it was something that was brought on by his generation. I think that Samson grew up in a wicked generation, right? This was one of the times in which Israel was disobeying. I don't think he was the only person that was going out to the Philistines and looking for wives. I think this idea of doing what was right in their own eyes is something he picked up from the people around him. And I think this is kind of the warning that I think that we can get from Samson, and that is when we lose this calling for radical obedience, we are influenced by the people around us, right? And all these other influences fill in, and we begin to do what is right in his eyes. And I think this also sheds light onto why Samson was called to be a Nazarite, right? To take a Nazarite vow, you were showing a sign of you being set apart for God. And I think God knew that Samson was going to be a judge in a generation that was like this, right? He knew that he was calling Samson to live apart and to minister in a generation that was going to do what was right in their own eyes and not what was right in him. And I think he was giving him a warning by him taking this vow, saying, listen, Samson, if you want to have an impact, if you want to not fail, if you don't want to fall, you need to have a radical obedience for me, right? And I want you to show that by having this Nazarite vow that other people aren't taking, because I want you to have an obedience for me outside of what other people are doing, because people are going to be doing what is right in their own eyes, and then you can't go that way. And Samson ultimately doesn't do that, and it ultimately fails. And I think this was really sobering to me when I thought of it in light of what Dave was saying to me, because what Dave was talking about is how when he looked into churches, he saw a lot of this, right? Is that the influence of our culture, right? We live in a culture that this is kind of what we do, right? We do what was right in our own eyes. You've heard people talk, right, about moral relativism, right? If you do what's right for you, then that's good for you. And it's influenced our churches, and people are doing what is right in their own eyes. And I think the warning that God gives to Samson is a similar warning, I feel, that Dave was kind of telling me. He was saying, listen, the people, not only the people outside the church, but the people inside the church, a lot of times they're going to be doing what's right in their own eyes. And unless you have a radical devotion to the Word of God and a radical obedience to him and have your mind focused on him, then whether or not you're in ministry or you're going to a church or you're in the world, it's all going to happen the same way. And you're all going to fall to this idea of doing what is right in your own eyes. And you're going to look to your own strength and your own wisdom, and you're ultimately going to fail, right? This is what's going to lead to the downfall. And he saw it lead to the downfall of church after church after church, where the leadership, they didn't realize, right, the influence that things were having on them, right? And they didn't have this radical obedience for God. And these sins crept up, right? And they weren't dealt with. Similar to how the Israelites, right, these people groups that were still in Judah, and they didn't deal with them. They chose not to deal with this sin, and they became like the world. So tons of stories of pastors that use funds to build pools, right? And they're just kind of skimming off the top. And the elders find out about it, but they're like, but he's a good preacher. And they carve their own moral path, right? Or you know, you see pastors caught in moral failings, and it starts as a small problem, right? And it grows into a big problem, right? Because all of a sudden people find out about it, and it causes church splits and church divisions. Or you see people that want to make church how they prefer things, right? And they don't want to do radical ministry, right? Because they don't want church to change the way that they're doing church. And you see it over and over and over again that people end up doing what is right in their own eyes, and they don't have a radical call to obedience. And if we as a church want to be different, we need to do something different than the churches down the street. We need to do something different than the churches around us, different than the culture around us. And we need to create an atmosphere of radical obedience to God, right? Like John was saying, a desperation, right? A desperation to do what God thought was right, rather than a looking to our own strength and looking to our own wisdom, right? To do what was right in our own eyes.
Amen.
Amen. And it was really kind of interesting as I looked, because it's easy to think about, you know, how to do that in church. And then it was interesting when it kind of looks back at you, right? So what about me? If I was Samson and I was living around all these people that are kind of doing their own thing, would I last? And it was easy for me to see times and just see ways in my own life that sin just kind of creeps up, right? And it's a shift of focus. I remember I was talking with Jane right after she got back from India. She did a mission trip over in like a year-long stint over in India. And people were like, you know, welcome back. You're back in America. You know, you're safe now. Like, things are great. And she was talking with me. She's like, you know, I don't like living in America. She goes, living in America is hard. And I heard that, and I was like, you know, what are you talking about? We're America. We're number one, right? We're the best. We're the best. Yeah. Our country code for phone numbers is number one. We're the only nation with that. We're number one, right? This is the best. And she began to talk. She's like, no, she's like, there's so many temptations that are here that are not in other places, right? In other places, people, you know, they have their own things, but certain temptations are just not there that are here. Like, we are here in America, and we get money, right? And we get power, we get a position, we get comfortability. And all of a sudden, you feel this draw to kind of find your security in that, right? The draw of greed, like, oh, I want to be able to save this up, you know, and I'll be fine. And you're not radically living for God, right? You're not radically following his obedience, because you have your own agenda and you can make your own plans, because things don't get crazy every other month, right? Because there is that stability. And And I think it was just kind of telling, because even in our own lives, right, similar to how the church can fall to the culture around us, we so easily can fall to the culture around us unless we set apart ourselves for radical obedience, right? To say, God, I want all of you, and I want you to be a part of every part of my life. And I want to cast out every sin, right, whether it's small or big, because I know if I don't do that, I'm not going to last. And that is one of the lessons of Samson. You're not going to last. You will not last unless you cast it all out, right? Because when you leave them there, they fester and they'll ultimately destroy you, right? This is ultimately Samson's downfall. So that's the first question, and that's a hard question. What is nice, I feel, is it's a two-question thing, and if you get one of them right, it can help with the other. And the second question is this. You can maybe probably throw it on the screen. Do you have the, it's like the, oh, there we go. Will we practice a life of accountability or isolation? And I'm going to pull something from this passage that I didn't really see the first time, but as I went back through it, I thought it was pretty interesting. Where does Samson go after this thing happens, right? So he has this run-in, right, where he kind of sins, right? He kind of goes after this Philistine woman. The whole thing gets blown up. But really, actually, nothing actually has happened to Samson yet, right? God shows grace to him, and even though he kind of is going in a sinful path, he still has his strength. Everything's still good. He goes back to Israel, but where does Samson go? Does anyone want to see where he goes? The cleft of the rock, yeah, the cleft of the rock or something, yeah. He goes off on his own, and I think this is kind of very telling, right? So I think this was Samson's second chance. This is not Delilah, right? This woman is not Delilah. He has not gone in with Delilah. He has not completely broken his Nazirite vow. He's broken one of them, but he hasn't completely broken his Nazirite vow, and he still has this second chance, but I think Samson really blows it here. He could have gone back to his parents, right? His parents were someone that was kind of a positive influence in his life. They're saying, don't marry this person, right? Choose someone from Israel. Or he could have gone back and other people could have shown up, right? And been like, Samson, what are you doing, right? You were called to deliver yourself from the Philistines. But none of that happens. And instead, Samson decides to live a life of isolation, right? He isolates himself from everyone in the community. He lives on a rock, just kind of out in the middle of nowhere. And we see that after this isolation, he falls again, right? And I think this is just really kind of a telling sign of what will happen when we have sin in our lives and we don't open ourselves up to accountability. And this was one of the main things that Dave was telling me about the church. He says, if I could boil down what the church needs today, after I've looked, right, to 40 different ministries, and he goes, what we need, he goes, is accountability. He goes, it's just that one word. We need accountability. He goes, the structures we have in place usually don't render themselves to accountability. It's like a lot of times it's either a one-man show or it's a few-man show. There's a few people with all the influence. People look to them, and they're not accountable to anyone, right? And that's where you get people that can have these long-term sin issues that are never brought up until they're a big issue, or you have this misdealing with money that's never brought up. And it happens because there was a lack of accountability. And it's similar, we see this in Samson's, right? He had a lack of accountability. And I think the reason he had a lack of accountability is I don't think Samson wanted it, right? He chose, right? He chose to kind of go off and not have it. And I think Proverbs has a really interesting verse on this. It says, there you go, whoever isolates himself seeks his own desire and breaks out against all sound judgment. Whoever isolates himself seeks his own desire and breaks out against all sound judgment. And I think this isolation was chosen by Samson, right? He didn't want to be accountable to other people because he wanted to do what he wanted to do. He didn't want to go back to his parents because his parents were kind of putting a damper on his plans. And I think so often in our lives, we don't want accountability, right? Because we don't want someone to put a damper on us. And oftentimes, leadership in churches and people high up in churches don't want accountability because it can slow down their plans, right? And I think it's something that so easily happens to all of us, but it can be a very, very long-term hurtful thing. And it's ultimately a thing of destruction, right? Because we have these things and people can get a lot of stuff done really fast, but it ultimately falls. And if we're going to be a church that lasts, if we're going to be Christians that last in the environment that we live in, we need to be people that live with an accountability to others. It also says in Ecclesiastes, it says, two are better than one because they get a good reward for their toil. For if they fall, one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him who is alone when he falls and has no one to lift him up. And though a man might prevail against one who is alone, Two will withstand him. A threefold cord is not quickly broken. And I think this is just one of the answers that we have, because we're not always going to be the person that has complete holiness, right? There are going to be sin issues in our lives, and this is how we get it out, right? Because when we fall, someone else is there to raise you up. And again, it was easy for me to be like, oh, okay, this is how the structure we want in the church. But then I kind of looked at my own life, and I was like, how much accountability do I have in my own life? So Dave talked about how when he walked into churches, they would set up goals, right? He talked about what they felt God's call would be on their church, right? Like, what does God want us to do? And he'd be like, okay. And he'd work with them. He'd take their goals and like, what goals should we try and do to make those things happen? And they'd all be excited, and they'd be like, okay, we want these things to happen, and we want to meet these goals, and this is what we want to do. And they're all excited. And then a few months go by, and Dave would come back to people and be like, how are we working on these goals, right? He'd kind of hold them accountable to those goals, to their call. And he'd always get kickback. People would be like, oh, you know, stop being so businesslike. This is church, you know? And he'd get kickback and kickback and kickback. And he realized people, they love the idea of doing good things for God. And they love the idea of living a life of holiness and stuff. But they don't actually want the actual accountability. They didn't want him to actually be there for them, right, if they messed up. And it's so easy for us to kind of push back against people that bring accountability to our lives, and really kind of that iron sharpening iron, right? The strain of iron sharpening iron and making us a better person. But it really changes, right? How we live when we live with accountability is different than how we live without it. And I think one of the interesting things, I kind of felt a little microcosm of this even just this week. So me and Jane both work at the camp, and this week we got completely opposite shifts from the beginning of the week. So it was like this weird phenomenon where we like didn't even see each other, because she'd work like 6 a.m. to 2, and I'd work 2 to 10, like 10:30, right? So she'd be in bed before I got home. And so I ended up with this ton of time that I was just like in the house, right? And I have like my list of, you know, things I got to do and goals to kind of help out with the house. And how many of them do you think I got done? Like none of them, right? Like, have you ever had one of those weeks you just don't get stuff done, right? And it's, I was like, man, I was, because it's kind of interesting, because I had this conversation with Dave. Are you looking at him? You never. Anyway, well, I didn't either, so. But it's like, I had this conversation with Dave right in the back of my head. I'm like, yeah, accountability, it's so great. And then I was like, you know, when I don't have accountability, I'm not so great of a person, right? Like, it changes things, right? It changes things when you have someone with you versus when you're just alone, right? And you do whatever. And some of these goals kind of go out the wayside, and growth kind of goes out the wayside. And if you're not careful, right, sin creeps in, right? So my call to you is this. I think we need to have a foundation for this church. And there's two parts of the foundation, and it's not revolutionary, but it's important, right? And the first is a radical obedience to God, right? We're concentrating on his word, and we are desperate to do his will, not our own desires. And the second is an accountability with others. And it can seem like a tough thing to kind of set up, but really it's walking alongside someone. It's sharing your goals with them and being like, hey, these are my goals. This is what I'm looking to do. So that way they're there when you're not reaching them, right? That's you know, sometimes the easiest way is the positive way. These are my goals, help me with those. And then as the relationship grows, these are where I'm failing, right? And help me with these. And so I'd ask you to think of us as a church, right? When we build this church, I really do believe this church is going to grow, right? And we might become leaders of a bigger church, right? We might become the elders and the pastors and the ministers of a larger church. And it's all going to go great, but are we going to last, right? And we're only going to last if we build a foundation. The time to build it is now, right? The time to build it is now. We're going to set the tone for this church, and the tone has to be that we're a church that will obey God at all costs, whether it's controversial, whether it causes conflict, whether it's uncomfortable, whether it goes against our desires, that we're willing to be radically obedient, and that we're going to be a church of accountability, that it's not going to be people looking up to us, it's going to be people alongside of us, right? And that we're going to have people in our lives that are going to help us when we fall, because apparently the great experiment has already been done, right? The churches have already tried without these two things, and they've all failed, right? And people go in, and they're just great big houses without foundations. And we need this foundation in our church as well as in our own life. So we're going to do a couple of things. I want this to be kind of a practical thing. So Jane's going to be handing out cards. And I just want you to take just a moment, just a few questions, and I want you to think them through. There's three questions on there. The first are, what are your spiritual goals, right? What are you trying to look to? Who do you want to become? The second is, what sins are keeping you back, right? This radical obedience. What are things in your life that are holding you back from that? And then third is, who can you share in your life your goals with? You know, it doesn't have to be someone crazy close, but who can you talk to someone about your spiritual goals so they can start having that accountability in your life? So I'd like you to take some time, fill those out, and then I'd like to have a little bit of a time of sharing, just kind of sharing what you all are thinking and what God is speaking to you through this sermon. So, we're just going to take a little bit of time and think those through and fill those out.